Hi, and welcome to the Overshoot Podcast,
a 9-part podcast series by the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, IASA.
My name is Frederik Hocke.
And I'm Francesca Grandolfo.
We are climate journalists and founders of Kurzschluss Redaktion based in Vienna.
In this podcast, we will interview 9 experts in different fields to understand how we can cope with a world post 1.5 degrees warming.
Each episode is a little sneak peek into the topics of the Overshoot Conference hosted by IASA in Luxembourg, end of September.
The Overshoot Conference will discuss in depth how we can navigate the risks, trade-offs, and opportunities that come with overshoot scenarios.
We are very excited to be able to talk to some of those experts in advance and hope you enjoy listening to our conversations.
Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back to the studio. This is the 7th episode of the Overshoot Podcast. My name is Frederik Hocke, and with me on my Zoom call is Christy Ebay, who is currently in Atlanta. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning.
Christy is a professor in global health and environmental and occupational health sciences in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington. She has been conducting research and practice on the health risks of climate variability and change for 30 years, focusing on estimating current and future health risks of climate change, and also designing adaptation policies and measures to reduce risks in multi-stressor environments and estimating the health co-benefits of mitigation policies. She has supported multiple countries in Central America, Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific in assessing their vulnerabilities and implementing and evaluating adaptation policies and programs. So I'm really happy you're here with me today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Before we dive into the health and overshoot scenario, let's just start with the basic on your topic. When we talk about climate adaptation and adaptation strategies, what exactly do we mean by that? So everybody's on the same page for the beginning of the podcast.
Adaptation recognizes that individuals, communities, regions are already experiencing impacts from a changing climate. The most obvious at the moment are extreme weather and climate events. Looking around the world today, there are heat waves in many, many parts of the world. There's been devastating flooding within the last few weeks. And in Europe, you're experiencing very severe wildfires. So people are already experiencing these impacts. And adaptation is a recognition that once there is a serious reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, there is a delay in the climate system for the global mean surface temperature to go down, which means that even with aggressive emission reductions, we'll see impacts for some time to come. And adaptation is the collection of policies, strategies, programs to prepare communities, regions, to support ecosystems that, of course, don't make their own decisions, to better manage these transitions of global mean surface temperature as they go up and in an overshoot or with very aggressive emission reductions on the way down as well.
Okay, and how do these measures look like? Maybe you can just give a few examples so we can grasp it a little better.
The numbers of examples are very large. There are adaptation plans for many countries under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. All countries have committed to developing national adaptation plans. And it's a huge range of issues. It's thinking about in agriculture, do you need more drought and heat-tolerant crops? Well, you have to develop new cultivars to get there. Disaster risk management isn't where anyone would like it to be at the moment. What needs to be done about disaster risk management? In health, it's focusing on the broad range of impacts of climate change on our health and well-being. This is mental health, vector-borne diseases, diarrheal diseases, undernutrition, air pollution, extreme weather and climate events, just to name some. And for each of these domains, then, there's a series of investments, underlying research to make sure we understand the risks and the multiple drivers of those risks, the different ways that current policies can be modified to be better prepared so that when something occurs, the health system is ahead of that risk. And as I said before, in looking at other ways, as we look across the complexity of these issues, the multiple interactions to ensure we've got the governance structures that we need, we've got the memorandum of understanding between health and meteorological services. I could go on and on. This is kind of a disorganized list, but it gives you a sense. The breadth of activities is very broad.
Okay, so I see. So we just have a really multifaceted topic to talk about today, but we will be focusing on your core topic, the health topic, a little bit later. Looking ahead into the future, which climate extremes do you think we will be needing to adapt to the fastest and the most urgently?
It depends on the time frame. When we look today, heat waves are a major problem in almost all parts of the world. In the United States, and I believe also in Europe, heat is the number one weather-related killer of people. That risk is underestimated. There are recent publications out of IS Global showing that the numbers are extremely large. The summer of 2022, there were more than 60,000 excess deaths from heat in Europe, which is obviously much larger than the number of deaths from people in flooding, for example. But as we go into an even warmer future, increases in the intensity of typhoons, hurricanes, cyclones will affect coastal communities in very significant ways. Flooding events will become more common. And so what's going to be most important is going to depend on the region and how prepared the region is, i.e., how effective are the adaptation options, to know the kinds of activities that need to be undertaken to protect people's health and well-being, protect our ecosystems, protect our economies.
Let's just try to frame the issue a little bit to start into the deep dive. The theme you will be chairing at the Overshoot Conference is built around the key idea that it's not so much the long-term level of warming that determines how we need to adapt, but rather how high the peak of global temperatures will rise. So the question is, how much will that peak temperature shape the way our societies can cope with it?
Those are excellent questions, and I will go back to part of the question. It depends on what area you're focusing on. So particularly for infrastructure, that long-term warming is critically important. Buildings last 50 to 100 years. Thinking about the consequences of higher global mean surface temperature for sea level rise, for example, will drive infrastructure decisions in many places. For the overshoot, it's two questions. One question is, how high is the peak? But the second question is, how long does it take for that peak to come down? And that is going to be very difficult in adaptation to manage. If you think the peak temperature will go down within a couple of decades, then that will drive investments. It will drive decisions into what needs to be done. If, for example, you're developing an early warning system for heat waves, you need to understand both. Because maybe there's some short-term adaptations that could be put in place during the overshoot that then could be sunsetted as the temperature comes back down. But if that overshoot is going to last for a long period of time, then building flexibility into the adaptation options so that eventually when temperatures come down, parts of the system could be sunsetted. It's going to make decision-making under climate change more challenging for the adaptation space. And thinking about, again, creating that flexibility and incorporating the latest understanding from science into how long the overshoot might last, in addition to how high is the peak.
Okay, so I understand it's a really dynamic situation right now, as we don't know what will be happening in the future, and we have to plan accordingly. Let's talk a little bit about your core topic, the health part of climate adaptation. How does the climate overshoot and warming temperatures specifically affect the human health? And what populations are the most vulnerable to health risks combined with hotter climate?
The health risks of a changing climate are incredibly broad. thinking about this broad range of risks, when you're talking about, are you talking mid-century? Are you talking further into the century? And which locations will determine who's most at risk? One of the big risks of a changing climate is in undernutrition. And it comes not just from climate change, but it comes from higher concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is decreasing the nutritional density of wheat, rice, barley, potatoes, and some other major cereal crops. And projections are that hundreds of millions of people will be affected by this. The focus often on food security is on people getting enough to eat. But there's also something called hidden hunger. And that's when people get enough calories, but they're not nutrient dense. So when you look at the number of people who are food insecure, I believe it's around 700 million people around the world are food insecure, about 2 billion have micronutrient deficiencies. And carbon dioxide will increase the number of people who could be affected by not getting enough nutrient-dense food. And we're talking hundreds of millions of people could be affected by this mechanism. And so just for that particular aspect, you can see it depends on the region. We know that there are parts of sub-Saharan Africa where cereal crops right now, wheat and rice in particular, are growing at the thermal edge of their tolerance. And so both climate change and carbon dioxide will significantly reduce food security. That's not true in every place in the world. When you look at high-income countries, major issues are around extreme weather and climate events, but they're also around issues on air quality. Spring starting sooner, fall goes later. There's a lot more pollen, a lot more people with allergies and asthma, with the consequences of that. And so it depends, again, on where you're looking and what time frame you're looking at.
Okay, that's actually really interesting, especially the nutritional part, because when you think about health, you don't think that big topic as part of being a health problem, but rather heat stress, allergies, air quality, as you just mentioned. What I was wondering, are there any health impacts that might become irreversible if the overshoot is prolonged, that we just can't go back after we reach or breach that 1.5 barrier?
There certainly will be particular challenges. Whether those challenges are irreversible, we'll find out in hindsight. Of particular concern are mosquitoes and ticks that carry a range of diseases, are already changing their geographic range, their seasonality, and the intensity of transmission. The numbers can be extremely large. Last year, there was a major outbreak of dengue fever carried by a mosquito in the Americas called Aedes aegypti. The year prior had the highest number of dengue reported cases, and I will emphasize reported cases. Most cases are not reported. Worldwide, there's about 300 million cases of dengue fever every year. Very few are reported. In the Americas in 2023, there was about 4 million reported cases, which was the most ever. In 2024, in February, because cases had already started being reported much earlier than normal, Brazil came out and said that they expected in Brazil alone to have 4 million cases in 2024.
Oh, wow.
By the end, there were approximately 12 million cases of dengue fever in the Americas. An earlier study did detection and attribution on dengue in the Americas and in other places, but concluded in the Americas, 35-40% of dengue cases are because of climate change. Obviously, that is a huge number. And unfortunately, outbreaks of dengue and of chikungunya, another viral disease carried by the same mosquito, are occurring in other parts of the world this year. So massive increases are possible going into the future in vector-borne diseases. In terms of whether that's reversible, is the mosquito I mentioned, Aedes aegypti, and it's Aedes albopictus in Europe, is completely adapted to human environments. It breeds around us. It can breed in the water in the bottom of a flower pot. So once it becomes established, it's difficult then to reverse that, that there's going to be significant efforts to try and eliminate the mosquito. And you could see how that could be possible as well with other kinds of vector-borne diseases. So there may be an element of irreversibility, even with overshoot, that as we come down, we may still have mosquitoes in a much broader geographic range than before.
Thank you so much for your detailed answer, which is actually a little bit scary to look at. Let's talk a little bit about health-focused adaptation and not the impacts that we'll be waiting for. So what role does the health-focused adaptation play in broader climate adaptation strategies? And how can the health systems prepare for the stresses that will be caused by overshoot?
Health is a critical component of adaptation, as are all other sectors. In most countries, there are some kind of national climate change team that includes representatives across the sectors to help facilitate collaboration, coordination, and integration. There is an effort undergoing right now from the World Meteorological Organization on early warnings for all. And ideally, from the perspective of WMO and others, those early warning systems are not just telling people there's a risk. There's a risk of a typhoon. There's a risk of a heat wave. There's a risk of an outbreak of vector-borne diseases. It's also, what do you do about that? Ensuring there's memorandum of understanding between the meteorological services and the health systems so that, in fact, one can design interventions that take advantage of the significant investments from the meteorological services to help improve health and well-being. And it is working together to make sure that decisions taken in one sector do not, in fact, cause adverse consequences in another sector. And that has happened often because decisions are taken within a sector without actually talking, in my case, to health, to see what would happen. There were some studies quite a few years ago for a part of Africa to increase micro irrigation to help improve food security issues because of challenges with the amount of rainfall, challenges with enough water for the crops. Those systems were effective in increasing crop production. They also created breeding grounds for the mosquito that can carry malaria. And so malaria increased in these regions. And that didn't have to happen. Because if there had been discussions between agriculture and health, then health would have said, you need to have bed nets as part of the program. And it's a perfect example for why working together is so important and how each of the sectors has something to bring to these discussions.
I understand. That was actually a little bit of a worst case example you just put there because of the mosquitoes growing from the water. Can lessons from successful health adaptation initiatives inform other sectors as well, just like turning the way around so we talk a little bit more together so we just learn from each other, kind of?
It's an excellent question. And looking at adaptation in other sectors, ultimately, many of the adaptations are for improving people's health, well-being, livelihoods. And incorporating health into those often make the adaptation implementation more attractive because people can see that to implement this will help themselves, help their families, help their communities. And so it can be a powerful driver of putting an adaptation in other sectors.
Yeah, that actually makes sense as we human beings kind of tend to be a little bit of egoistic. So maybe that's the way to go. Let's talk a little bit about planning of adaptation strategies, because that's also what you do. You advise a lot of countries on their adaptation strategies on rising temperatures. How does an overshoot scenario change the way adaptation strategies are planned?
If we knew, the broad we, scientific community, policymakers, communities, knew we were going into overshoot, then thinking about adaptation raises questions that have to be answered at the level of the communities themselves. They have to be answered scientifically on how much investment and where to focus investment. Because if we'll just focus on heat, it's rather simple. It's going to get hotter, but the temperatures are going to come down. How much investment should there be in cooling? How much investment should there be in redesigning cities, planting more trees? We know that increasing tree coverage reduces heat-related mortality. And so thinking across the basket of options, knowing ultimately the temperatures will come down, can help inform the prioritization of those investments.
Which countries do you think, from your perspective and your expertise as a policy advisor all over the world, are most at risk when overshoot coincides with low adaptive capacity?
We know that everywhere has challenges with their level of adaptation. Looking at extreme events, if communities, countries were better prepared, we wouldn't see the impacts we're seeing right now, which says there's a long way to go even today. It's well understood that places that are poor, are marginalized, have greater challenges in terms of adapting. And that's for a range of reasons. Human and financial resources comes to mind first, but also many of these communities, there is limited data. So better understanding exactly what risks they face, exactly how those risks interact with the broad range of drivers, is important to be able to use resources most effectively.
You just talked a little bit about the financial perspective of adaptation. What role should wealthier countries or international finance mechanism play in the context of having a fair and distributed adaptation strategies all over the world?
The UNFCCC states that there's a common but differentiated responsibility, and that holds again today. And it is both in terms of financing, but it's also in terms of technology transfer, early warning systems, helping understand which pieces of early warning systems are most effective, what can be implemented in lower resource settings. And having that knowledge and then transferring that has been critical for moving adaptation forward. We're seeing the consequences, starting to see the consequences of the choices of the Trump administration to reduce funding, for example, of USAID. And there's projections that tens of millions of people may die as a consequence. It's the lack of investment. It's also the lack of access to, for example, drugs. It's the lack of technology transfer on what can be done to help protect against whatever the particular concern is. And so it is a responsibility nationally. And as one looks around the world, it's really excellent to see many philanthropic organizations are stepping forward and taking to heart this common but differentiated responsibility and building the capacity for research and for adaptation implementation in low resource settings.
Thank you so much for your clear words. When talking about adaptation, the big topic of mitigation is also really close. What do you think? How do adaptation and mitigation strategies go hand in hand? And why is it important to think these two dimensions of climate action together rather than separately?
I'll focus on two aspects. The first is that many options are both adaptation and mitigation. Redesigning our cities to help them be cooler is mitigation and adaptation. There's been an artificial separation, and thinking more holistically as one looks at these options and sees that there are potential to improve adaptation, improve mitigation. I know there's some efforts in some of the international adaptation funds to move in that direction, which is really helpful. In health, for example, there's large efforts to put solar panels on healthcare facilities, which is really important, excuse me, if you have, for example, a vaccine that requires a cold chain. It also is mitigation. So yes, we need to do those together. And the second part of the response is there is quite a robust literature that the health benefits of mitigation policies are often of the same order of magnitude, if not larger, than the cost of mitigation, that focusing on the health benefits of mitigation will then move forward faster because people will see that we need to mitigate for our health. Further, those health benefits occur sooner than the mitigation benefits for reducing global mean surface temperature. Often see the health benefits, getting people walking and biking, for example, people are healthier, has lots of benefits for their health at the same time while you're reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but people get healthier faster than global mean surface temperature comes down. So focusing on the health benefits of mitigation is a powerful incentive for mitigating and should, in my opinion, come forward more often instead of hearing statements about mitigation is going to cost X percent of global GDP, have the next sentence be, and the health benefits will be of the same order of magnitude, if not larger.
That's an excellent example. Let's talk a little bit about policy and the global perspective in the end of our talk. How should international climate policy incorporate the overshoot possibility into adaptation framework and programs? What is there to do for policymakers, decision makers, politicians?
We're at the very beginning of that discussion, that policymakers are just becoming aware that overshoot may be a possibility. And there's been very limited effort then to start thinking about what does that mean for adaptation and how to incorporate that into adaptation frameworks. Under the UNFCCC, essentially all countries conduct vulnerability and adaptation assessments. It's their first step in understanding their risks, what they need to do. From those, they develop national adaptation plans. They're not incorporating overshoot and starting to think about what overshoot could mean in their context and how, if at all, that would alter what they're planning to do. And finding ways to bring those discussions together so that the vulnerability and adaptation assessments do include consideration of overshoot. Another piece I'd like to bring in is there is a set of tools that are called stress tests. These are desk-based exercises. The military calls them war games. The military does war games literally all the time to help the military plan for an uncertain future, a future that is different from today. Banks do stress tests, and I firmly believe that using stress testing will be very important to increase preparedness for extreme weather and climate events, outbreaks of infectious diseases, other big health events, but also in other sectors. Because people have a very hard time in general imagining a different future from today. And these are ways to help people understand what a future could look like and what needs to be done to manage it. And incorporating that into the vulnerability and adaptation assessments would be a big step forward into incorporating overshoot and how to manage that.
Okay, so to sum it up, there's still a lot of work to do. We are already at the end of our talk. Is there anything you would like to add to this topic we were just talking about the last half hour?
Thank you. The piece I really would like to add is whenever we're working on adaptation and mitigation, to focus on reducing inequities. Inequities are driving so many of the challenges we're facing around the world. Unless there is explicit attention paid to reducing inequities, those will persist and will continue to challenge communities or countries. And so let's reduce the inequities while addressing adaptation and mitigation in an overshoot context.
It was actually an excellent closing word you just gave there. Thank you so much for your time, and it was a pleasure talking to you, Christy. I'm really looking forward to meet you in October in Luxembourg.
I look forward to it as well, and thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow and give this podcast a good review. Thank you, and hear you soon.